Good evening. Welcome to the Soleri Report. Today is Thursday, October 22nd. I'm Catherine Austin Fitz, and I'm delighted you could join me this evening. Tonight we have Money and Markets, and then Ask Catherine, then the Global Chessboard with William Engdahl. He's coming in from Frankfurt, Germany, and William didn't want to do the Soleri Report at 3 o'clock in the morning from Germany, which would have been the time, so we agreed to pre-record. So I've heard this interview, and it's wonderful. I wanted to do a full hour with William. We're covering both his work with incredible book, Seed of Destruction, about genetically modified food and the effort to control the food supply, and also Full Spectrum Dominance, which is about the geopolitics of energy and gas. So I wanted to do a full hour. So we're going to go about 90 minutes tonight. If you're not able to stay with us this evening, I hope you remember that you can listen to the MP3, which we'll post by tomorrow afternoon. Then in Let's Go to the Movies, Sidney Pollack's espionage thriller, 3 Days of the Condor, I'm going to focus on the last 6 minutes, which is up on YouTube, of all places, and which we posted on the blog post about tonight's Soleri Report. Our theme for tonight is freedom, only because freedom's been so much on my mind as I reread William's books, talked with him, and reviewed the stories of what was going on this week. And I think it's because there are many conditions to the creation of freedom and the maintenance of freedom. One of them is that our minds are free, and so it is so important that we have an honest map of the world and can see the world as it is so that we know how to use our time and our knowledge and our skills for whatever purpose we choose to have. And so part of being free is having good maps, and that's one of the reasons I so appreciate Engdahl's work. As the economic bubble diminishes, and that's what we're watching right now, and we've been watching for several years, or we're not even watching, we're participating in it, what we're seeing is more and more people realize that what is going on is not about just about the money. It's about control, including control of people and the resources that people desire. And in fact, that control game is shrinking a lot of economic value and a lot of financial wealth. And so we're seeing that the game is more than anything about control as opposed to just money or wealth. And at the very heart of the battle for control, if you look at the sort of what are some of the key strategic resources, one is precious metals at the very heart of what the new currency will be and how it will work. And then there's the battle for control of the seed supply and food system. And I've talked in prior Soleri reports about why I think that's so instrumental to the creation of a global currency. And then the battle to control energy resources. If you read Engdahl's book, Seed of Destruction, he describes the use of genetically modified food, control of the seed supply, and industrialization of agriculture to exercise political and economic control. And then you read Full Spectrum Dominance, and you learn about the efforts to control gas and oil. In the first hand, digesting these books, I've read them both twice now, digesting these books you may want to take a spa day and say, oh, the truth is overwhelming and depressing. Interestingly enough, the day you start to realize that Weems' map is very, very good descriptor of what's going on, then you're going to be inspired, if you haven't been already, to take action, build local food systems for you and your family, increase your own energy self-sufficiency, buy and invest in precious metals. All of those then decentralizing the very resources by your taking those actions that the efforts are underway to centralize. And so I'm hoping that kind of, you know, really honest map will help you do that. There's the decentralization of ownership and control of strategic resources is at the very heart of creating and maintaining our freedom. Okay, money and markets. Big question in the financial world today is, and all week long, is the stock market sustainable? I put up on the blog a chart of the current PE in the markets compared to the historical norm, and it's so off the charts you don't even know what to say. I mean, it looks like the, you know, it looks like the cliffs of Dover going, the PE's rising. There was a wonderful interview in September with one of my favorite financial authors, Robert Kiyosaki, who's the author of Rich Dad, Poor Dad, and he made some reference to the Fed pouring money and intervening into the stock market. And the commentator very crisply asked him if he had real evidence that could prove the Fed was intervening in the stock market. And he kind of rolled his eyes. He didn't even answer the question. He kind of figured it was all sort of hopeless. But I think if he had honestly answered it, he would have said, you know, you have to be brain dead not to know that something is very amiss. So we're watching an incredible bubble. James Turk today published an article that charts the relationship between the monetization in the Fed balance sheet over the last couple of years and the rise in the stock market. And I've put it at the top of the blog. It's very much worth taking a look at. You've seen a lot of sort of the financial world congratulating themselves on all of this because it is no mean feat to protect the dollar, keep yields low, keep the bond market rolling along with this kind of Fed monetization and keep the stock market up. So it's quite a juggling act, and a lot of people are in the media congratulating themselves. The risk issue is as follows. To defend the dollar, Bernanke's going to have to raise yields, and if it comes down to protecting the bond market versus the stock market, we are running the real risk that global stock markets could go through a real step down in valuations. So in the game of protecting the dollar or protecting the bond market against the stock market is bound to lose. And we've seen that several times in the last 5 years. It could come again. We've also seen a lot of crowing in the media that emerging markets in China are opportunities. And I'm a skeptic. In the long run, there's no doubt about it that capital and technology is shifting to those areas of the world that have young population. So those are the long-term trends. But if you look at bubble economics over the last 10 years, the bubble that we're dealing with and the bursting of the bubble that we're dealing with in the United States, it's the same in the emerging markets in China. You'll see places in China where, you know, you have office towers that are empty, the same kind of real estate problems that you have here. So in the short run, I'm a skeptic. There are lots of predictions that the dollar is about to die momentarily. Problem is a lot of people don't want it to die, and that's not just in the United States. It's all around the globe. The more the dollar drops, the more it's going to hurt economies in Asia, Europe, Latin America, around the world that depend on exporting to the United States. So it's not just the domestic economy that's been dependent on the federal government pumping out tons of purchases and contracts and subsidies to people than buy things from abroad. It's, you know, this is a global dependency. And unfortunately, what we're watching is a strong preference everywhere for the slow burn as opposed to crash and burn. I know some of the subscribers are concerned about Cliff High's report predicting a real global meltdown this Sunday, October 25th. But every sign we're getting so far this week is more slow burn. Now, the reports from the labor side of the equation are heartbreaking. We're watching lower pay, less benefits, trouble with pension funds. My prediction is we haven't begun to even hear the truth on that side of the equation. More layoffs, more unemployment, and every indication that much of this is being translated into permanent labor policies. It makes you wonder sometimes if healthcare reform isn't just a way to protect the drug industry and the healthcare industry's cash flow when half the people in America are either laid off or lose their healthcare benefits. And indeed, in fact, reports from Washington this morning indicated that drug companies believe their profits are going to improve with healthcare reform. So what we're watching in the slow burn scenario is we're watching the inflationary effects of printing more money and a liberal monetary policy being offset by policies that deflate the value of labor. And this is part of a process that began with the World Trade Organization and GATT in the mid-90s. It's been going on, and we didn't notice it, many of us, because we were enjoying bubble economics. And now that the bubble economics are going away, we're just watching a long-term fundamental trend that's been going on for quite some time. Now, speaking of labor policies, the administration pays our has just announced that they're controlling compensation for the banks and companies that got the bailouts, intimating that the cut is up to 50%. Talk about cutting somebody's legs out from under when they go public. A banker was quoted in the Wall Street Journal today as saying that the 50% number was a bit of a hoax, and the explanation is that they are shifting compensation out of cash salary and into stock options and various equity policies and bonuses that don't get counted. And so the change is really a change out of cash salaries or annual cash salaries into other kinds of benefits. And what you're watching is it's almost comical because for many years in this country, we've run with the CEO of a company telling politicians one thing and then their employee shareholders about the opposite thing. And we're coming into a world where suddenly they can't do that anymore. The political activist finds a way to get on the analyst call that was intended for investors, and suddenly the world is tightening up. Now, what is also happening at the same time that you have the Pazar trying to hold down the compensation and negotiate the compensation with banks and companies that are on the public dole, we're watching a couple companies who, thanks to unbelievable gifts from the Treasury, Goldman Sachs and J.P. Morgan Chase and other firms report the likelihood of incredible bonuses. Lot of press about the Goldman Sachs bonus pool. We talked about it last week, but it's coming up again. it just keeps getting better. We have an interview in the Guardian in the UK. An interview with Goldman Sachs' vice chairman, who apparently was interviewed to do, you know, his job was to go out and do damage control on the bonus pools. And the headline is, "Public must learn to tolerate the inequality of bonuses," says Goldman Sachs' vice chairman. And the lead comment is, "One of the city's leading figures has suggested that inequality created by bankers' huge salaries is a price worth paying for greater prosperity." Now, the extraordinary thing about this comment is it reflects an incredible naivete about how the economy really works. Because if the economy, we have watched the financial sector be pumped up to an incredible degree and strip the real economy in a way that is, for most people, destroying real prosperity. So what we're doing, in essence, is we're centralizing wealth in a way that shrinks it. So the pie is getting smaller. Now, it's certainly getting bigger for a few people at the top. But centralization is wealth-destructing, not wealth-creating. So the notion that these bankers are being paid to create prosperity is ridiculous, particularly when you're talking from an investment bank that just literally through the AIG bailout got a $10 billion gift. In other words, Goldman Sachs got 100 cents on the dollar on a whole bunch of paper they should never have gotten 100 cents on the dollar from. It's unbelievable. The notion that a body politic is prosperous because it has a tapeworm and the tapeworm deserves to get bigger and better bonuses is so what you realize is, you know, we've reached a point in the bubble where these guys have literally forgotten how the system works, you know, and that may be helpful so that they can go out and say absurd things, but it's quite extraordinary, and it's a little bit more frightening than thinking they're just arrogant, because literally we're watching people who are in control or in very influential positions who literally have forgotten how the economy really works. I want to just take a second to compare this. As Assistant Secretary of Housing, I had to deal constantly both with federal programs and state and local programs in which people got housing subsidies or got to buy houses with subsidies or at discounts. And for years, I went through the sort of the model issues of if the government puts in various kinds of financing or income subsidies, should the government get a right to the equity? Does the government have a right to cap salaries? So there's a whole world of thinking and policy work and research on the policy issues of if government pays, what does that mean to the income or the equity ownership of the people who benefit from that? So, you know, and this has been going on for decades, if not centuries. So there's a model. If you take the model that is applied to poor people who get HUD subsidy, housing subsidy, or people on welfare or people on food stamps, and you take the lessons of what would be applied to their income or what would be applied to their equity, and you just flip that model over, then the government would own Goldman Sachs, J.P. Morgan Chase, and Citibank. We'd own 100% of the equity, and all of the people who work there would be subject to the getting paid the same as a GS-15 or an SES, but would be capped at government salaries. So there is an incredible double standard between the income and equity model applied to people who get government subsidies in the lower income groups of society versus the ones in the upper group. And those models are getting clearer and clearer to a whole variety of people, and I think it's probably going to take, at the current discussion rate, about another 6 to 18 months before it really moves out into a clear comparison in the public consciousness. But as it does, watch for fireworks and watch for the possibility of real change. Okay, ask Catherine. Lots of great questions. One, someone asked me about the DVD, The End of America, that Naomi Wolf has published, and I have not seen it, but I will, on your recommendation, I will get it and make an effort to watch it. Shane Ellison of thepeopleschemist.com, the question is, can you try to interview Shane? He's an organic drug chemist who once worked for Big Pharma and opted out due to the rampant corruption he noticed in industry. He just released a great new book that I believe would be worth having him discuss. I will also make an effort to get that book and read it. And again, any suggestions you have for people who should be highlighted on the blog or in the Solari Report, I'm delighted to get it. And I will, I'll watch the DVDs recommended, and I will certainly try to read the books. Great question number three, Japan. Compare and contrast Japan to the U.S. Japan is often noted in mainstream media as having lowered their interest rates to sub-zero levels for decades and yet have not experienced any type of inflation that I can see. Can you compare what happened and is still happening in Japan to U.S.? It's a very good question. In 1989, at the end of the last housing bubble burst, the United States went through a process where we really marked to market the housing and real estate industry. We continued to support the stock market. But what happened is a huge amount of capital flowed out of real estate and flowed out of older industries into new technology and younger industries. So you literally had the capital go from an older generation to a much younger generation. And that was very, very healthy for our economy in a lot of ways. Not to say that everything going on at that time was healthy. There was a lot of centralization, the precursor to what we're dealing now, which was very unhealthy. But certainly pulling money out of the older industries and pulling money out of the older generation to shift to younger industries and to younger people was very productive. In Japan, they didn't do that. They kept the real estate market propped up. They kept the large older industries propped up. And you literally saw a much more managed and controlled economy from the early 90s on than you did in the United States. What we're watching now is the U.S. doing something like that domestically, in the sense that they continue to prop up real estate, prop up the stock market. This kind of incredible printing of money and monetary support to the financial industry. We have a financial industry that's about 40% of our domestic product. We need one that's maybe 15%. So we're basically pulling money out of the healthy parts of the economy. We're stripping the real economy and pumping up finance and pumping up fraudulent finance. Now, that's domestically. If you look at what we're doing as a global entity, in fact, we're following some of the same rules. We're pulling money out of the aging population in the United States and out of the older industries, and we're moving it all abroad. Now, some of that is just sort of an economic play. I shift manufacturing into Asia. When it leaves, I only own 10%. When it arrives, I own 100%. So part of it is just more economic warfare. But there's no doubt the shift of capital out of the United States into countries that have younger populations and have much more sort of dynamic, hardworking cultures is part of, it parallels sort of what we did in 89 and 90 than what the Japanese did. So we're doing Japan domestically, but we're not doing it globally. But it's a great comparison, and it's worth understanding the issues of what happens when you manipulate the cost of capital down to some players, and you end up with massive capital flowing to support control instead of flowing to support the most productive kinds of behaviors and kinds of investments. Another question, does Cliff High have any updates? Not to my knowledge. The last one I know was his warning about October 25th, which is this Sunday. Just FYI, somebody I work with sent me a notification. The largest securities clearing firm, which is owned by one of the big New York banks, put out an announcement this week that they're shutting down on Saturday the 24th for business continuity system work. And I thought, oh, Lordy, what a coincidence. I'm not going to answer questions on precious metals. I'd like to defer those to our next precious metals report with Franklin Sanders. Ditto, we got a great question on inflation and SDRs, and I'll handle that at precious metals market. For those of you who were not on the Solaria report last week, I also wanted to mention the question that keeps getting the most votes for me to answer is, let me just read it to you. On June 18th, you mentioned your protocol for telling the truth without getting killed. Please tell us. So in response to the interest on that question, I'm working on a special segment on that topic for a later Solaria report. Okay, well, now the global chessboard with William Engdahl. It's my pleasure to get this recording going. Gary? It is my great pleasure to welcome to the Solaria report William Engdahl, who's joining us from Frankfurt, Germany, where he is one of the finest researchers and writers on, as his website describes, geopolitics and geoeconomics. And I just wanted to read a favorite quote of mine from Francis Bacon because it reminds me so much of William's work. The contemplation of things as they are, without error or confusion, without substitution or imposture, is in itself a nobler thing than a whole harvest of innovation. When I read William's books, and I just this weekend reread again two of his latest, Full Spectrum Dominance, Totalitarian Democracy in the New World Order, and Seeds of Destruction, The Hidden Agenda of Genetic Manipulation, I am continually, I'm so impressed with his ability to understand what is happening and to do the extraordinary research and document what it takes to create a simple, a clear, understandable, accessible picture and map of what is going on on the entire globe in terms of the geopolitics of seed and food or oil. It's really very formidable intellectual accomplishment. And so it's my real pleasure, William, to have you join us on the Solaria Report. Our topic today is the grand chessboard, what's next. And I don't think there's anybody more qualified on the planet to answer that question. So thank you so much for taking the time to join us from Germany.
Well, it's a pleasure to be here with you, Catherine.
Well, I thought maybe you could walk us a little bit through your background, because I must say, to write and integrate, you're integrating lots of different fields of knowledge, from food to energy to space to science to military, and you're dealing with all countries, all places. It's pretty incredible, and yet you have a framework, you integrate it down, you make it so understandable to people who are not expert in any of these particular expertise. So you must describe your background and how you managed understand all the money in the planet.
Okay. I'll try very briefly. My ears are burning from your descriptions here, but basically I grew up in the Midwest and later in Texas. That's where I was born toward the end of the Second World War. Did my university studies in international politics at Princeton in New Jersey on the East Coast, and worked for about 10 years in various areas in the East Coast, from Boston down to New Jersey. Then I got into journalism, working in New York during the 70s and the first oil shock and the food crisis of that period. And I really began at that point, I guess, getting captivated or drawn into the politics behind the oil crisis or the oil shock and the whole politics of energy at that time, because that was a titanic change in energy policy in the U.S. and in the world. So one thing led to another. For health reasons, I came over to Europe, where I'd done graduate studies at the University of Stockholm in international economics, and I came back to Europe, this time to Germany in around the mid-80s. Where I met my wife, who's German, and one thing led to another, and I'm still in Germany. But I think in terms of what you are asking about, perhaps the fact that as an American, having grown up in American culture and with an American ideology, I've lived an extensive part of my life outside the United States, and therefore can see things outside the goldfish bowl that a lot of people can't see when they're inside. I know myself when I reflect on my time inside the U.S. trying to understand certain things, it's vastly different. So I suppose if anything gives me a little bit of a different view on that prism of reality, I guess that's it, the fact that I've had experience in so many different countries and cultures. And then, of course, in the last, the last 10 or 15 years, traveling extensively all around the world, as a result of my writings. So it all adds up. You know, it's like throwing, as a friend of mine says, throwing mud on a wall. Sooner or later, some of it sticks. And if you keep doing something for about 36, 37 years, sooner or later, you figure out a few things about how the world works, I guess.
Now, why did you start were you publishing books before 2004?
The original of the Century on Century of War, a small German edition came out a few years before that, during the first Iraq War, and then it kind of lay dormant. A friend did a publishing a reissue of it in 2003, briefly, and then I republished it in London in 2004, the version you're talking about. It's gone through that, and since then, The Century of War has been translated into 8 different foreign languages, about to be 9 with the Japanese edition. And the other book, The Seeds of Destruction, has also had 8 different foreign language prints. So,
you must tell me what inspired you to write Seeds of Destruction. Why don't you first explain what it is, and then how you...
Okay, sure. Well, the Seeds of Destruction is really, it's a story not simply about GMO. There are quite many and some quite excellent books out there on genetic manipulation of seeds and plants, like soybeans, cotton, and so forth. But what I realized was lacking was a political understanding of the policy of patenting seeds by 3 or 4 giant multinational corporations. I had worked when I was over here in Europe my first years, I had worked extensively in Brussels and around Europe with the GATT-Uruguay round on trade talks, where agriculture became a major platform for the gap round for the first time in history. And that led, of course, to the creation in 1994 of the World Trade Organization in Geneva. So I had background in the workings of the grain cartel. I suppose, if anything, the leitmotif or the connecting thread of my writings is a study of power and the misuse of power globally. But I, at that time, became quite immersed in the workings of Cargill, Archerdown in Midland, Bunge, at that time Cook and Continental Grain, in controlling agriculture policy of the European Union, of all things. These are American companies, for the most part, and they were controlling the critical agriculture policy on grains and other things in the European Union. I found this out from investigative journalism at the time. And then when I came across the fact that three or four multinational companies, this is about 7-8 years ago, three or four multinationals had dominated the patenting of seeds for the basic foodstuffs, the animal feed like soybeans and corn and also rice and cotton and so forth, and that those three of those four companies were American-based, not only American-based companies, but these were chemical companies that had worked for decades in collusion with the Pentagon war machine in chemical warfare, and had lied about their history of involvement with things like Agent Orange in Vietnam, dioxin and so forth, PCB, and the damage it had done not only to the communities where their factories were located, but also to their own workers. So Monsanto, Dow, and DuPont, three of the four big horsemen of the GMO apocalypse, as I call them in the Seeds of Destruction book. Then I realized, as I dug further, I was doing journalistic work on this, and I just was not only fascinated, I was outraged by the idea that three or four multinational private companies, regardless of how pure their track record might have been and how charitable and good-willing, that three or four private companies potentially, as the trend was going back then, stood to control and dominate the most vital seeds for the human food chain, maybe 10, 15, 20 years down the line. That kind of power in so few private hands is something that the world had never seen before in history. So that not only got my dander up, it got me very curious as an investigative journalist. And lo and behold, in my research, I found that the entire project of GMO traced back to initial seed funding from a foundation in New York called the Rockefeller Foundation. Well, hoo-hoo, alarm bells started going off there.
Right, the people who brought us the Green Revolution.
Yes, exactly, the Green Revolution in agriculture. And so the book project actually deepened very much into a study of the history of the Rockefeller faction in the American establishment primarily after World War II, but it even goes back before that, because the GMO project, the genetic manipulation of organisms, the GMO project of the Rockefeller Foundation traced back to the 1930s and their work supporting this. Most people in the world aren't aware of this. Nazi eugenics. Eugenics is the purity of the race, the Aryan purity that Hitler used to talk about and so forth. Well, the funding for the Hitler-Nazi eugenics program at the Kaiser Wilhelm Institute in Berlin and also in Munich, brain research program, forced sterilization program, studies of twins and so forth, that, Dr. Mengele, the various Nazi doctors that became infamous at Nuremberg, that was all funded right up until 1939 by the Rockefeller Foundation, hundreds of thousands of dollars, the equivalent of tens of millions of dollars in today's money. So, and the Rockefeller Foundation and these elite members of the U.S. establishment were passionate about the idea of reducing the world population of undesirables and breeding, like you would breed a prize line of horses, breeding the elites to their desire. And they had dreamed of, they even created a special field of biology, a totally bogus field of biology, but sadly to say, it's the hegemonic dominant field of biology today called molecular biology. And the idea is that you can reduce life down to a little ball of matter called a gene. And then their mad dream is if we can somehow manipulate the DNA of that gene with foreign objects to our satisfaction, we can create a Frankenstein monster. We can create, a superior race. We can create Lord knows what, a race of zombies that will do whatever we tell them, I guess. I don't know.
Right, and also as an economic matter, we control all the forms of plants and foods through patents.
And the WTO, the creation of WTO, was absolutely central to that. So the book is really two things. It's one, a project that was started. You mentioned the Green Revolution, which was Norman Borlaug of the Rockefeller Foundation going back to the 1950s and his work in Mexico with wheat varieties. But the idea then was the Rockefeller group of companies had all these chemicals, nitrites and so forth, nitrogen chemicals, that they'd used for the war machine during the Second World War. And they didn't know what to do with it. They said, well, let's get a market for it. Someone came up with the idea of creating chemical fertilizers. Then they came up with the idea, well, let's mechanize the agriculture in Mexico and places like this so we can introduce gasoline and our petroleum-based fuels. So they created this concept of agribusiness at Harvard Business School back in the 50s. And one of the founders of the project who worked with the Rockefeller Foundation back then, Ray Goldberg, he's, I think, 93 years old today. He still sits on the board of about 20 or so different agriculture multinationals, many of them involved in the patenting of seeds, GMO.
One of the many things I thought was really valuable in Seeds of Destruction is it's hard for most people to understand the force, both the political force and even the physical force, that is used to suppress any research or knowledge which would contradict, for example, the safety of genetically modified food. And you see, there are a couple of great stories, the researcher in Scotland, where you describe the incredible power that's brought to bear to stop the truth from coming out about all this stuff.
Yeah. Well, that's a good friend of mine. We've become friends over the course of his reading my book and meeting at conferences. Arpad Pusztai, who's now in his mid-70s. And in 1997, he was perhaps the world's leading researcher on genetic modification of plants. And at that time, he was also a convinced fan of GMO. He thought, this is the solution to world hunger, as the Monsanto mafia proclaims it. And so they did long-term studies financed by the British government. Tony Blair had just become Prime Minister when these studies were being done. And the studies were to show that rats fed with GMO potatoes versus a control group of rats actually had enhanced features, positive results. After 3 months of testing, Pusztai, who's a very serious scientist, he'd been widely published in peer-reviewed journals around the world, he went to his chief and said, I have found some extremely alarming results. I propose that we go public with these immediately to warn the world to hold off before, commercializing GMO seeds and unleashing, letting the genie out of the bottle on the world's population, that we warn people to do much, much more research because, and he did. He went on Channel 4 in the UK and announced that his test results, and he's a very careful researcher, showed that the organs of the rats fed with GMO potatoes were dramatically shrunken in size compared with non-GMO rats' diets of non-GMO food. And not only that, he didn't dare to put this on television, but he said his research also showed that the brains of those rats were dramatically smaller than non-GMO rats. So his chief, of course, was alarmed as Arpad was, and okayed this 48 hours after the broadcast. It went around the world. It was picked up in all newspapers, of course, sensational. 48 hours later, his chief came in at the Rowett Institute and told Pusztai, pack your things. Your desk is locked. Your computer is locked. You have no access to your data files. You're forbidden to talk with any of your colleagues. And you're forbidden to talk about any of your research on GMO to the press. End of story. Goodbye.
Right.
And he found out years later, after he had suffered a heart attack, his wife also became gravely ill as a result of the shock of having your life's work suddenly turned into disgrace. And he later found out it was a phone call from Tony Blair to the head of Rowlett Institute after the broadcast. And Blair, he later found out, had gotten a phone call from none other than Bill Clinton, the U.S. president, who had been told by Monsanto, shut this guy up in Scotland or we'll kill the whole GMO project that we're counting on.
Right.
I had
a similar experience. I was dealing in a situation where we had hard evidence and facts to prove that something was, you know, the sky is blue. And mm-hmm. and people are getting calls from the White House and or they're telling me higher from the White House saying that the sky is green. And it's, you know, when that comes down on you, it's just unbelievable to watch. But is that, you know,
I'd be interested in the higher than the White House side of that story.
But I used to try to get a name. Who exactly is higher than the White House? But in my experience, there's, you know, a lot of people higher than the White House. Well, that's
the White House are simply the errand boys of the establishment.
Right, right. Before I ask you sort of who's really doing this, I just wanted you to touch on total spectrum dominance, because that...
Full
spectrum dominance. That is just, it's incredible. I just read it again this weekend. It's just also an incredible book. So maybe if you could just describe it briefly.
Well, in following in an ongoing way the whole issue of oil in the post-Cold War era, if you want to call it that, to my mind, the Cold War never ended in 1991 with the collapse of the Soviet Union. Washington simply continued to build up its military machine, and in violation of its solemn agreements with Mikhail Gorbachev back in the early 90s, the U.S. went on to extend NATO right up to Poland, the Czech Republic, and various other nations that were formerly in the Warsaw Pact. So the only weapon or the only counter lever that Russia had, its economy was a shambles, it was in ruins after the Yeltsin years of plunder and so forth, was the huge resources of especially natural gas, the world's largest gas resources reserves, but also of oil, the world's second largest oil producer. So under Putin, they kind of started to get stabilized, to get the economy stabilized, get the pension payments to the elderly stabilized, something that the Yeltsin clan didn't really bother about. They just were too busy lining their own pockets. But then Russia began engaging in energy geopolitics to try to counter this huge military pressure that was building on its borders. And then in 2006 or 2007, I'll have to check that, but in any case, I think it was February 2007, the United States, the Bush administration, announced that it was placing missiles on Polish territory under U.S. command and control and advanced radar systems in the Czech Republic in order, quote-unquote, to deter any rogue missile attacks, end quote. And when pressed about this, the U.S. with a straight face claimed that these were rogue missile attacks, of course, from Iran or North Korea. Well, as Putin very caustically pointed out at a conference in Munich, Germany that year, a few weeks later, that's like using your right hand to scratch your left ear, as we say in Russian. You don't put missile defense installations in Poland to guard against Iranian missiles. You put them in places like Azerbaijan or Israel or whatever, but certainly not in Poland. These missiles and this missile defense is aimed at Russia. And that kind of became the trigger, because I realized this thing was getting to the point where, if people in your listenership recall the brilliant Stanley Kubrick movie, one of my favorites, Dr. Strangelove, How I Learned to Stop Fearing the Bomb. In any case, the idea of a nuclear war by miscalculation is a present and imminent danger because of this madness that's been pursued by Don Rumsfeld and the Pentagon and by the current administration. Keep in mind that the just because Obama announced that he wasn't going to go ahead with the missiles in Poland and the advanced radar in the Czech Republic. They're doing it on board U.S. naval ships and other countries, including potentially Georgia, which is even more threatening to Russia. And the whole point about missile defense is it ain't at all defensive. It's offensive in the
right.
highest extreme. Because if I'm standing across from you and we're armed to the teeth with nuclear warheads, and I have a missile defense, even a primitive one, in Poland and the Czech Republic, I can launch a first strike. I have nuclear primacy. I can launch a first strike and pull it off because your few missiles that will survive the first strike will be knocked out by this primitive missile defense. So it gives the U.S.
Right, and I would say it another way. I have my missiles there, so you have to buy Fannie Mae securities from me.
Yes, exactly. And Russia is the fourth largest holder of U.S. Dollar debt or dollar reserves.
Right, nuclear primacy. And one of the things I love about full-spectrum dominance is you really describe the institution of nuclear primacy, what it is and what it means. But from my point of view, one of the things it means is that we literally can create a global taxation system through the balance sheet.
Anything. Yeah,
yeah.
Exactly. And see, the point about Russia is not really about Russia per se. Russia's I've been there a number of times, and believe me, they are the last people and last country in the world that wants to go on an aggressive war track against the United States or anybody. They haven't even recovered from the Soviet era, let alone the free market shock therapy of Jeffrey Sachs in the 90s.
Right.
And but they do have intact the only nuclear defense in the world that's capable of strategic countering of the U.S. nuclear arsenal. China doesn't have that. China's small nuclear arsenal is very, very much regionally defensive for countries like India and so forth. So China, without a convincing Russian nuclear capability, is a paper tiger, to coin a phrase from Mao back in the earlier era. But China, in an alliance, even a peaceful alliance, economically and otherwise, with Russia, like the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, that is a combination that people like Zbigniew Brzezinski, in his book The Grand Chess Game, warned about back in 1997. Eurasia has everything. They have the population base, the raw materials, the technology, the scientific know-how to exceed American hegemony in the world.
And they have the young people.
Yeah, oh yeah.
Yeah.
I travel there quite frequently, and the one thing that's striking is how young the population is and how dynamic.
One of the things you bring out, a quote there are a couple quotes I often use that you bring out, but one is, I'm a great believer if you're going to go from a world of a planet run through national sovereignty to a planet run through corporations, that oil does not do it if you're, you know, as a backing for a global currency, you need food. And you've got that great quote from Kissinger,
oil, you control whole nations. If you control food, you control the people. If you control money, you control the whole world.
Yeah, and yeah. So I'm very curious. So you go through the food control, you go through the oil control, and between those two books, you can see the issues of control and the issues of shifting from national sovereignty to corporations. And so I know your new book is called The Power of Money, so I'm dying to know when it's going to be available.
The title is provisional, but yeah, okay, sorry to cut you off.
No, I just would love to know when it's going to be available, because I'm foreseeing the integration of these things into the money game.
Yeah. The provisional title is, right now, is The Gods of Money, Wall
uh-huh.
Street, and the Death of the American Century. It's kind of a dramatic title, but I think it expresses it. And these are the people behind this securitization crisis really see themselves as the gods of Mount Olympus. We're above any kind of man-made laws. We're above any controls. We take what the taxpayer has because it's ours, it's not theirs. And As John D. Rockefeller, the founder of the Great Standard Oil Trust, said back in, I think, 1901 or something, a reporter asked him how he became the world's wealthiest man, and he simply quipped back and he said, "God gave me my money." I love that quote because it sums up the arrogance and the hubris of this tiny little clique. But in reality, when I studied at university, I sat in the same classes as some of these people with family names like Rockefeller or Hormel or DuPont or who knows what. And they are very, very paranoid people on a private basis because they're terrified that, quote-unquote, the masses are going to steal what they stole from them, you know, from the majority of the people. So most of them are extremely unhappy as individuals on a one-on-one basis. But they cover it up with this great arrogance and this great drive for power.
Although I must tell you, William, in the 90s, because I grew up in that world, my family was very intertwined with the Rockefeller interests, and and something happened, and I've always believed that that it was the creation of a satellite technology. And the critical issue when you invest in emerging market or you invest in Asia, and you saw this in investment from Europe in the United States after the Revolutionary War, the question is, where can enforcement go? Because you don't want to put money unless you can enforce, and you don't look to the formal laws to enforce. You look to your ability to, you know, have a Pinkerton man show up and knock them out. And so the question is, you know, did the institution of satellite, global satellites and satellite weaponry give us then the ability to, you know, to shift money? And so something happened, you know, and whether it was the growing sort of corruption and dirty money in the United States or the satellites or something happened in the 90s when the WTO kicked in, it was as though that whole world had gone mad and went to a level of arrogance that was just stupefying. And to this day, I still try and figure out what exactly, where that's coming from.
The satellites indeed may well play a technological role, but I think you put your finger on it, Catherine, when you mentioned the creation of WTO in the mid-90s, because a good friend of mine was a journalist based in Geneva covering the WTO. He was a Greek journalist writing for the Journal of Commerce back then. And he told me that the crucial point, and he used to talk, you know, he was so well-known over there that the heads of companies like Nestle and the big multinationals would occasionally drop a tidbit. And he said, what they told me privately is the one non-negotiable term of the creation of WTO is that they have free movement in and out of these emerging markets of capital, repatriation of capital. And once they got that embedded in WTO, and once they arm-twisted, you know, what is it, 132 member nations into the WTO, China wasn't at that point a member, but it later became one, then they had this ability to move capital. And if you go, well, you recall the Asia crisis in 1997 with the Thai baht and so forth. You know the background to that?
Well, my 2 cents on all of that was basically they pulled credit. It's pump and dump. You pump it up with credit. You pull the credit. You dump.
Exactly.
And then you go in and force them, one, to sell their equity to foreigners at 10 cents on the dollar.
Yeah.
And it was, you know, they basically jammed the place, and the part of the horror of it is you had basically hedge fund operators going in and behaving like pigs. And
you had three hedge fund operators going in behaving like pigs, and I'll name the names because it's on the public record, and Mahathir in Malaysia had the guts enough to say it in public and was called an anti-Semite, but it was the Quantum Fund of George Soros, it was More Capital Management, it was the Tiger and Jaguar Fund of Julian Robertson. I think the fund is now...
And wasn't Texas Pacific in there someplace?
They may have been, but the three big ones who ran a court... I had people in Switzerland in the bank regulatory system who were in Thailand at the time tell me from the inside story there when the Agriculture Bank of Thailand president's office, when the president got a call from these hedge funds, and the hedge fund said to him, "Don't try to resist. It won't work. We have so much capital behind us." They had credit lines from the big New York banks and some of the European banks, but mostly the big New York banks. And the capital flows in these countries. Up until that time, these countries had no, these were the so-called Asian tigers. You never hear the term anymore.
Crisis.
But the Asian tiger economies, what was incredible is they had done the Asian miracle with their own capital. They didn't go to the IMF hat in hand and borrow money or to the New York or London money center banks. They did it through their own savings culture. And therefore, that the powers that be in Wall Street had a heck of a time getting in and getting the control. So they did exactly what you described. The Treasury went in and put enormous pressure on them. Believe you me, I'm sure you know this from your experience in government. The Treasury, when they put pressure on a small country, they can put ferocious pressure.
And right, and they can use covert violence behind that. It's not just political pressure.
Yeah.
You know, there's
and,
a lot of dirty tricks
well, the
that go
economic hitman, I think, is anecdotally a hint in the kind of pressure that can be brought to bear. But South Korea never had free capital flows until that was done. And once that was done, you had the inflow, the pump and dump that you described, where you had this huge capital, relatively huge for these small stock markets and bond markets, from these hedge funds, and backed by off-the-books credit lines from the big banks. And they pumped up, they created real estate bubbles in Bangkok and Jakarta and other places. And then they pulled the plug, and it was a military operation, starting with the smallest, and then just going boom, 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 right up to North Korea, to South Korea. And Hong Kong, and at that point, it started threatening to get systemic because the Japanese were secretly pumping money into to prop up the Mahathir in Malaysia because that was the Japanese banks were threatened. So
right, what we're really talking about, and I think in one sense it may be what you mean by soft warfare, but we're basically talking about economic warfare that uses surveillance tools that are deeply invasive of privacy. I mean, we're talking about actions significantly outside the law in a variety of ways. And that's why when people call it capitalism, I keep saying, this is organized crime.
It make Don Corleone blush.
It's very funny because, I'm sure you've read some of the stuff I've done on sort of the organized crime model in the United States and the comparison to what happened in Russia or Asia or some of the other places. Mm. And I went to see the chief of staff to the Senate, the chairman of the Senate appropriation that oversees HUD and the 21 agencies in the early 2000s. And I was just trying to get my company paid, so I was being very discreet. And the person looked at me and said, "What do you think is going on at HUD?" You know, referring to basically all the federal housing money and federal housing policy and regulation.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, "I don't know. What do you think is going on?" And they looked at me and said, "HUD is being run as a criminal enterprise."
Mm.
And it had taken me 12 years to get to the point. I said, "Well, I don't disagree." Now, HUD's run on a matrix structure. That means you need the Treasury, the Department of Justice, and the New York Fed member banks and the big defense contractors who run HUD to run it as a criminal enterprise. And so what they were basically saying is, the federal government and its finances are a criminal enterprise, which I, in fact, now believe was true, but for the chief of staff to a Senate, appropriation chairman, subcommittee head to say that is an amazing admission, and that was 8 years ago. So
did he keep his job?
What?
Did he keep his job after that?
My impression is they kept it for a while, but suddenly got cancer and I think the model is one, for anybody who's seen The Godfather or any of the mafia movies, the model is one we all understand, and it's really a question, and that's why I love your work, of being able to fathom that you can operationalize it on this kind of centralized scale, and you can not only pump and dump a stock, but you can pump and dump a country.
Entire countries, whole region.
And they're doing it.
Yeah. And the upshot of the Asia crisis in 97-98 was a capital flow reversal, and the head of the Bank for International Settlements made this comment in a speech 2 years later. He said, "We've had a dramatic shift in global capital flows. Instead of capital going into East Asia economies, it's going out into the dollar to the tune of hundreds of billions of dollars a year to
yeah.
prop up the U.S. debt markets and to prop up the U.S. government. So that was the great Clinton recovery, financed by the flight capital out of Asia after the crisis. So it's,
right. That whole period, we extracted capital from Russia, Eastern Europe, Asia. I mean, it was incredible, the stuff. And what was interesting to me, William, was as we were propping up the dollar, we were extracting enormous amounts of capital from the U.S. I've written a lot about Fortran going missing and you know, money being shifted out of pension funds in ways that I believe was both legal and illegal. But, you know, massive amounts being extracted here as people were lulled into thinking things were okay by the bubble.
Yeah.
And, you know, so basically you smash them down in terms of equity. You pull money out at top dollar here and move it to buy things at 10 cents on the dollar. And the trillions of dollars that a syndicate could extract from that, you know, sort of multi-step process is, you know, it's more than people can fathom.
Yeah, yeah. The model that I tend to revert back to history to try to understand these things, because I think that's the best kind of guidepost, is the British East India Company.
Mm-hmm.
And keep in mind, your image of criminal enterprise, there's no more criminal enterprise than the East India Company. They ran the opium war against China in the 1840s, or even before that, in order to bust open the Chinese resistance to quote-unquote free trade, Adam Smith and the whole lot. But there were American families, New England families, very reputable, you know, Cabots and people like this who were Peabody's, who were involved in that opium trade as well and made their initial fortunes that way. So this private company with a royal charter,
right,
is really the model you're talking about, where the private, these select private interests, not just any private interest, but select private interests. So it's socialism of the private sector. I don't think the word socialism is really appropriate.
One of the one researcher who I love is a wonderful attorney in Texas named Linda Miner, and she went back and studied the history of land investment after the Revolutionary War.
Mm-hmm.
And she says that the affirmation of the charters after the Revolutionary War were one of the critical turning points in history, because that whole charter structure was affirmed by the courts, and so the Revolutionary War didn't change the fundamental investment controls, you know, both from particularly England but Europe.
And, fascinating.
Yeah, and it is quite fascinating, because you see this sort of shadow investment network that's really controlling behind the scenes, and in some senses the Revolutionary War, you know, it just kept tootling along, Revolutionary War and no Revolutionary War, and a lot of it has to do behind the university endowments, the networks in and around Harvard Endowment, Yale Endowment, you know, and you see it's very overlaid with the families in the China trade that you describe.
Exactly. Yeah. Interestingly enough, one of the things I uncovered in researching the Gods of Money book, which I hope to get out in the beginning of the next year, because it really isn't a book about the crash. It's a book about the control of the money, you control the world in terms of the American side of that in the last 180 years or so. But one of the things I came across, there's a great body of literature about the creation of the first Bank of the United States by Alexander Hamilton, and if you go to Washington and the Treasury Building, which you know very well, you see this beautiful statue of Washington. He's treated almost like one of the gods of money, really.
Uh-huh.
And, well, Hamilton, it turns out, was a snake in the grass in terms of American national interests, and he created the first Bank of the United States as a private entity, despite the name, and the major shareholders were foreign, and the major foreign shareholder was N.M. Rothschild, or Nathan Rothschild at that time in London.
Uh-huh.
So the same interest that the United States and Hamilton supposedly had fought a Revolutionary War only less than a decade before came in through the back door to control the money of the United States.
Now, I have to confess, you know, my company in Washington was named after Alexander Hamilton, and we'll have to have another discussion at some time, because I still, you know, I'm still a Hamilton fan, although my picture of what happened after the Revolutionary War has changed some.
Yeah. Well, maybe the German Friedrich List is a better model for spiritual planning, but that can be debated.
Well, my experience on Wall Street, I tell the story in the Dylan Reed about how the, you know, basically a partner at Dylan Reed told me that basically the Rothschilds were in charge and were appointing the people who ran us. And I kept saying, you know, what did the Rothschilds have to do with us? So, you know, nothing has changed in 200 years. Another thing I wanted to ask you, William, is what do you think, you know, one of the themes we see in Afghanistan and the sort of encirclement of Russia by the United States, diplomacy and military policy, one of the themes we see is narcotics trafficking. And those cash flows, as we know, have been critical for hundreds of years to the Anglo-American alliance. And I'm curious as to how important you think the narcotics trafficking is as sort of a part of the economic model of Afghanistan and the encirclement of Russia.
Oh, no question that it's essential. You can look at the United Nations data for the opium harvest in Afghanistan under the Taliban, where they almost disappeared to zero under Taliban policy. And immediately after the U.S. Bombing and occupation of Kabul, the opium warlords were allowed to just flourish like never before in the record harvest of opium. One of the obvious apparent goals of that was to flood Russia with cheap heroin to addict its youth and create even more social disorder in Russia. And it's a huge social problem in Russia. That's because Russia is right along the drug routes into Western Europe and beyond for the opium products out of Afghanistan.
Do we have any understanding of how much of that opium is going to Russia and how much to Europe?
I don't have an exact breakdown, but a huge amount is going to Russia that wasn't going to Russia before the U.S. occupation in 2003. So, you know, that alone indicates part of it. And the U.S. Government has the war on narcotics in Afghanistan has been from the get-go a joke, because I don't think it ever was intended to be a war on narcotics. It was used to discipline certain warlords that didn't play the Washington game, perhaps. But
it was used to facilitate the, among other things, it's really a control game. And you finance it by, you know, the war on drugs makes it easier to control the narcotics trafficking and make sure the prices stay up.
It's sort of
my experience.
That's interesting.
Now, we just saw a G20 meeting in Pittsburgh with the formerly G8 coming out and saying, you know, let's migrate to G20. And now we have the IMF saying, well, let's be the staff for the G20, giving the G20 a real institutional support.
Oh,
I'm curious.
Staff like that, you can forget it.
I'm curious of what you think of this shift of G8 to G20 and then moving IMF underneath it and creating SDR rights on IMF. You got any take on all of that?
Sure. I think it's very obvious. The acronym Misery Loves Company, or the G8, de facto bankrupt. And what do? They grab the people who have resources left, China especially, but also Russia with their huge minerals resources and technology resources, but also, you know, Brazil. India is really far behind those three, but I think the purpose of this G20 is exactly that, simply to lock in the block of countries that are most inclined to go an independent way in the current crisis. I don't think that's going to succeed.
Do you think it reflects Putin's success in backing us down a little bit in Georgia and on the missile defense?
What, the creation of G20?
Mm-hmm.
No, I wouldn't connect it there.
I think
it's desperation. I saw statistics from Credit Suisse Bank a couple of days ago documenting that the mortgage resets in the United States and various ARMs and so forth, we're about a third of the way through that process, and it's not going to start declining until something like 2012. And, you know, there's a whole new wave of commercial mortgage defaults that's already begun.
Right.
I mean, big names like Tishman and so are just walking away the way small homeowners are having to do, walking away from billion-dollar properties that they no longer can consider worth it. So, you know, as I said on one recent interview, the United States economy is going to go through 10 years at least of pure economic hell, the way that the policies that are being kept intact. You know, the Obama administration brought in let me say it bluntly, the criminals responsible for creating the deregulation of these financial markets back in 99 and 2000, namely Larry Summers and Timothy Geithner. They were brought in, quote unquote, to clean up the mess. Well, that's worse than letting the fox guard the hen house. It's, you know, sticking a hen in the mouth of the fox.
Well, it's a little bit, I liken it to a leverage buyout, because you issue fraudulent paper and use the money to take control, and then once you have control, you take the cash mm-hmm. and the remaining wealth and use it to pay off the paper you issued to engineer control.
Yeah.
Because basically what the bailout's done is it's just papered over the fraudulent, you know, I mean, trillions of dollars of fraudulent paper that was, and it was very intentional.
Yeah.
I mean, this was not some mistake or accident.
No.
You know, trillions of dollars of intentionally fraudulent paper and derivatives were issued. And the question in my mind is, you know, where did the money go? Because I think a lot of the bailout is simply, you know, covering that up and cleaning that up. And then the question is, where did the original proceeds go?
Hmm.
So, you know, $64,000 question.
Yeah. $64 trillion question.
Exactly. You know, it takes a lot of money to buy a planet, but if you look at all the money that went missing, you know, if you take the $12 trillion on the bailouts, the $4 trillion that went missing, you know, that's enough to buy up a lot of the planet.
Mm.
You can certainly buy up a lot of Africa for that.
Yeah.
One of the things I wanted to ask you about is the German election and the Irish referendum, sort of the latest events in Europe and what they mean.
Well, let me step back from that specific question and give you my sense of Europe at this point of the process. Back in 99, we saw the creation of the European Monetary Union and the euro as a single currency for qualifying countries. And it was a supranational currency with a supranational central bank, but with no supranational political agency. So there's a huge democratic deficit, as they call it over here. But the idea was to fill a political and a power vacuum that was emerging in the eyes of certain European elites, emerging with the decline of the United States power globally. And I think, and this is speculative on my part, but I think the 1992 operation of Soros' Quantum Fund against the pound sterling, the man who broke the Bank of England, that's a fairy tale. I think an operation that risky for those high stakes could only be done based on 100% certainty that you knew exactly where the bones were buried, because you had access to highly, highly sensitive intelligence. So let's assume that the knocking of England out of the euro was a U.S. establishment or a Wall Street establishment operation designed to keep the City of London out of this new single currency. So now you have Europe, and I think they're schizophrenic. The European elites are schizophrenic. I observed this process now for more than a quarter of a century. On the one hand, they can't stand the policies of the United States. They are sick and tired of being bullied around by Big Brother America on military policy, on telling who should be admitted into NATO or who not, on economic policy, on financial policy. They're furious at the United States government for allowing this toxic waste to be poured down their banking system over the last decade. But in a sense, they're terrified as well of breaking loose from that Atlantic bridge and drawing closer to Russia, to China, to the Eurasian continent. And I think until they resolve that schizophrenia, there's not going to be anything interesting coming out of Europe. It's simply going to be a dying continent with demographic catastrophes staring them in the face and sinking into irrelevance. That's a very harsh indictment, but it's they've either got to, you know, as the folk expression goes, in Texas where I grew up, you got to cut bait or go fishing.
Right, so it's kind of like choosing between your evil twin and
yeah.
and going out there into the great unknown.
I know what I would do if I were the German chancellor or German industry and banking. I certainly would not hesitate to explore the opportunities on the Eurasian continent. It's just unbelievable opportunities here.
Yeah, oh,
unbelievable.
It's true.
And a lot of German industry and bankers have historical ties to Russia, historical ties to Central Asia, and they know this. It's just, it's the untapped riches of this planet are there.
So I could spend all, you know, I could spend an hour on this, but we only have a second. But one of the many things I love about the full spectrum dominance is you talk about what I call soft, or you call it soft warfare,
mm-hmm.
and the color revolution, but specifically the role of foundations and not-for-profits, of NGOs.
Right, NGOs, yeah.
And, you know, this is a very vicious game that the NGOs have been playing, and they're often held out to as the sort of the goody-two-shoes. And maybe if you could just say a minute on what's really going on with some of these NGOs, it would be terrific.
Sure. Well, in almost every case where there's been an upset of regimes in the last, going back to the end of the 90s, starting with Serbia and Milosevic and so forth, and going to Ukraine, the Rose Revolution, Ukraine and the Orange Revolution, Georgia with the Rose Revolution, hand-picked dictators, and these are dictators, these are not nice guys, were put in there by Washington, financed by the National Endowment for Democracy, which masquerades as a private NGO. All its money comes from Congress, as well as the Open Society foundations of George Soros and company. The Soros foundations, Open Society, as well as the Human Rights Watch, it's a machine. I call it the democracy movement machine or the human rights machine. And that is used to do, as one of the participants called it, to do what the CIA used to do a quarter of a century ago, but do it privately. And it's simply, the Russians caught on to the game after the Ukraine Orange Revolution in 2004, and the Chinese now. There was an attempt at it in Tibet back in April 2008, which earned me the love and affection of Mr. Soros and one of his foundations in a court of law for my exposing certain things, writing about certain other things. But these color revolutions and this democracy, every time I hear the word democracy uttered by an official of the U.S. government these days, my ears perked up, and I say, oh, there's some dirty business about to happen in this country. And sure enough, it usually is the case.
Yes, whenever somebody says we're here to help you, beware.
Yes. we're here to help you into retirement. We're taking over.
Now, tell us, the New World Order, will it succeed? Okay, I'm totally in agreement with you, but I want to hear your reasons why.
Okay. And this is why I titled my next book, The Gods of Money, Wall Street and the Death of the American Century. The American Century was proclaimed by the establishment, Henry Luce of Yale University and Time Life magazine and so forth, triumphantly proclaimed in 1941, before the war was even over. They said, this is the American century. This is our empire. This is our world. We're going to call it the world of democracy and free enterprise, but it's our empire. And that American century really has been about the creation of a new world order, as George Bush and others have referred to it over the years. And what is that new world order? Well, it's nothing other than the whole process of globalization, as Clinton called it. The idea is that dollar capital would literally take over, like a spreading cancer, if you want, or some kind of fungus, would literally take over whole sections of the world economy and bring it under centralized control. And that, it broke down. Something ran amok with the 2007 collapse of this small semi-state-owned bank in Germany, the IKB Bank in Dusseldorf, filled with toxic waste from U.S. real estate that Deutsche Bank had dumped on it. And once that happened, everybody around the world started rethinking this whole, as Greenspan used to call it, financial revolution, or revolution in finance, or the securitization revolution. and said, hey, wait a minute, this isn't as kosher as we thought all this paper was. Who knows who stands behind what, who owns what? And they got their lawyers to look at this stuff, and they said, geez, Louise, we're sitting on toxic waste here. So I think, let me say something very harsh. I think it's analogous to the role that the British elites, the British establishment found itself in between 1873 and 1945, or between 1914 and 1945. And they fought two world wars, and the U.S. elites fought two world wars to decide who would be the successor to the collapsing British Empire. But that empire is based on a model, and no mistake about it, the U.S. model that these elites created around the Rockefellers and so forth in the late 30s and in the 40s that created the United Nations, that created this and the other, that whole model is a model based on parasitism, based on, well, now it's openly, as you say, based on criminal enterprise masquerading as official government agencies. But this is the end phase, and there are no big places to loot short of going to world war. You know, China, I can tell you, I've been there recently, they are not about to roll over and play dead and
right.
Give their $1 trillion of reserves or anything more, or their labor power to sink more good money after bad into the dollar system. So as I put it, the dollar Titanic is sinking, and the rest of the world is looking at it and saying, okay, do we go down with the Titanic in a brave act of blind stupidity, or do we try to scrape for ourselves? So I think it's going to be a messy period of, multipolar is too refined a word for it. It's going to be a messy period of several different centers of regional power, short of a world war that's going to annihilate the planet. Let's hope.
Well, I think the Anglo-American Alliance has a lot more rabbits it can pull out of the hat. But at the end of the day, there are two things I see, William, and one is, I don't know if you're familiar with the Chinese term. I studied Mandarin in China long ago, and the Chinese term, the mandate of heaven.
Yes,
ultimately, to govern significant resources and power, you have to have a higher purpose and a higher authority than comes from simply force.
Yeah.
You know, and you have to have that higher moral authority. That's number one. Number two, if you run, and it's a big planet, it takes a lot of logistics to get up and get the trains, running on time. and you can't have the trains running on time if you're pumping and dumping the railroad every 3 years. Because ultimately,
can't even find the red boxcars.
Right. Well, ultimately, the non-productive drives out the productive. And one of the challenges that the Anglo-American Alliance has had for centuries is, how do we run the overt and covert efficiently without messing each other up?
Mm-hmm.
And so what we're all struggling with globally is how do we change, because ultimately, in my experience, you can go all the way to the top and everybody's a prisoner of the model.
Yeah.
So the question is, how do we get free? How do we get to be not a prisoner of the model? And it's hard when you have so many people running around and having a great time, making fortunes in $12 trillion bailouts. And so part of it is, what has to happen to get the leadership to realize, this may be fun now, but it ain't going to go the distance.
Yeah.
So it's going to be, I agree with you, it's going to be quite a, well, with all this said, William, here's my question. What's the action? What can the listeners do? What can we do to protect ourselves, to navigate the environment, and possibly to help shift in a more positive direction?
Catherine, I would go back to that beautiful quote from Bacon that you read at the beginning. First of all, and it's a deliberate policy result, most people are bathed from their birth to their death in ignorance about what's really going on in the world and why it's going on. The first thing people need to do, and what motivates me to write and do what I do, is through circumstance, I happen to have a window on certain things that many people don't, and it's, if you will, it's my mandate personally to to take that and try to publicize that as widely as I can around the world. But the first thing I think people need to do is find out what it is they're up against and strip away the rose-colored illusions they have about democracy or President Obama being the man of real change and just give him a chance, this, that, and the other thing. I think no American president since Lincoln, with the possible exception of Kennedy in his last months, was ever got close to the White House without being a team player from the establishment.
Right. Well, and, when you think about it, Obama has done more for the Rockefeller and Rothschild's interest than any president yet.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Now, the global warming scam, the this multi-trillion-dollar cap-and-trade thing that Goldman Sachs set up in Chicago with a foundation that I found out the other day that was Obama was involved in when he was in Chicago.
Really?
So, yes.
Well, I've always said derivatives were just the beginning. Where do you see cap-and-trade?
Oh, yeah. They're drooling at the mouth at Goldman Sachs and other places.
And, to another disclosure, I worked as an intern at Goldman Sachs in 1977. Anyway, but okay. Well, before we go, William, if you could just give us a little bit on how to follow your work. How do we keep in touch with what you're doing? How do we learn about the new book when it comes out?
Okay.
How do we follow you? How do we support you in what you're doing?
Okay. Very simply, I have a website where most of my public articles I publish in a variety of websites: financialsense.com. Global Research, occasionally in Asia Times, then translated into different languages. But the best way for people to follow it is my website, which is, if I can give that URL.
Yes, please.
There. It's www.engdahl.oilgeopolitics. It's a long word. It's one word, oilgeopolitics.net. Engdahl.oilgeopolitics.net. Or if anyone just Googles my last name, Engdahl, and then oil, you'll come up with a website right near the top. And, that's one way to follow what I'm doing and thinking. The other is the books are all available online through Amazon and other outlets. So Full Spectrum Dominance is just been, it was for technical reasons out for several weeks, but now it's back up today. I just saw, so people could order that. And now.
Well, last week on the Solari Report, we did the precious metals report with Franklin Sanders. And
mm-hmm.
When Franklin heard that you were going to be on the next Solari Report, he said, "You have got to thank that man for me. I don't know how he does it."
His stuff over the years. He's one of the more interesting commentators.
He said how he can read and digest all, my nickname for the New World Order is the tapeworm. He said how he can read and digest and document and footnote all that tapeworm propaganda. God love him. Thank God he does it, but I couldn't do it.
Yeah.
And
becomes an addiction, I guess. I don't know. It's what I do.
Okay, well, you do it fabulously. And again, for the listeners, Seeds of Destruction, Total Spectrum Dominance.
Full Spectrum.
I don't know why I didn't keep saying that. Full Spectrum Dominance. Just absolutely fabulous books. And, of course, your first one is Anglo-American Alliance.
Yeah.
Fabulous. Anyway, so, William, thank you so much. Have a wonderful a wonderful day, and I hope to get you back before too long.
I'd love to. It's rare that I get a chance to have such a stimulating discussion with someone, so I'd be more than happy to come back.
Okay, great. Okay, let's go to the movies quickly. I posted the portion from 3 Days of the Condor, which is Sidney Pollack's marvelous 70s espionage thriller. Robert Redford is an analyst in a, I guess they call it a literary or historical society, but it's basically a CIA front in New York, and it's a group of analysts who sit around and basically read all the books that are published in the world. And Robert Redford's report tickles the wrong people, and the next thing you know, a hitman comes in and kills all his colleagues while Robert Redford is out getting lunch for the crew. And somebody who's basically been operating on the overt side of intelligence finds himself involuntarily on the run, living in the covert side. And it ends with a wonderful sort of description of the red button problem, where the Cliff Robertson, who's playing the New York CIA chief or a member of the New York station, and his name is Higgins, confronts Redford and with sort of the reality of the hard work that the people who run the country really have to do when it comes to resource control, and I'll just read it. Higgins says, "It's simple economics. Today it's oil, right? In 10 or 15 years, food, plutonium, maybe even sooner. Now, what do you think the people are going to want us to do then?" And the Robert Redford, Joe Turner says, "Ask them." Higgins says, "Not now, then. Ask them when they're running out. Ask them when there's no heat in their homes and they're cold. Ask them when their engines stop. Ask them when people would have never known, who have never known hunger, start going hungry. You want to know something? They won't want us to ask them. They'll just want us to get it for them." It's a very, very poignant moment, and it's worth watching to understand the feelings of the people who have to get in the trenches in operation, oil and other resource access and control in the real world. Then Turner tells the Robert Redford character, tells Higgins or Cliff Robertson, that he's just given the whole story of what has happened with the assassinations and the effort to kill him to the New York Times. And Higgins says, "Hey, Turner, how do you know they'll print it? You can take a walk, but how far if they don't print it?" And Turner says, "They'll print it." And Higgins says, "How do you know?" Now, it's interesting that New York Times was famous for a number of exposés of the CIA, including the Church Committee in the 70s, which was several years before Pollack produced 3 Days of the Condor. I will tell you from my own experiences with both the New York Times and the Washington Post, I have seen an extraordinary amount of manipulation and censorship, including personal experience at those two papers. The reality is today the chances of the story getting printed are very, very, very small, unfortunately. Anyway, 3 Days of the Condor, it brings up some of the most important issues of resource control and media. It's entertaining. Robert Redford is always fun. So I recommend it as the fictional version to go along with reading Engdahl's books. So that's it for this evening. Thank you so much for joining us. Coming up on November 5th, we have Money is Spiritual Practice with Mayori Onerheim, a wonderful accountant from the San Francisco Bay Area. Our movie is, we're going to talk a little bit more in detail about Michael Moore's Capitalism, A Love Story. It's in the theaters now if you haven't seen it. November 12th, Precious Metals Market Report, and this time we're going to go in depth and talk about the Sir James Goldsmith interview with Charlie Rose in 1994. You can find it up on the YouTube. It's linked from the blog. So until next week, ladies and gentlemen, thank you for joining us. Please remember, don't worry about whether or not there is a conspiracy. If you're not in a conspiracy, then you need to start one. Good night and good luck.